Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie, and you heard yesterday from Anne Lacumber, Frank Lacumber, about John, their father, and diagnosed with C. diff, which is extraordinarily contagious and very worrying for anyone over 60, basically, we're told. And the difficulty he had in an A&E unit for 3 days, and worried not just about the infection, worried about passing on the infection because it's highly contagious. Nicola, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. What is your story, Nicola? What happened?
Yeah, well, for me, I actually have Crohn's and I have colitis. A lot of people would know that as an immune illness with stomach ulcers and things like that. And I went into A&E this time thinking that it was a flare-up of my condition. But I spent 3 days in A&E, and on the second day, I was diagnosed with C. difficile, or C. diff is the short name for it.
Right. And what happened? So you were put in isolation then, were you?
Yeah, I went in. I had what that unfortunate caller had as well, the abdominal pain and the severe vomiting and diarrhea and that. It was actually quite, it was very frightening and it was very sudden. So at the first night, I actually spent, I didn't get a trolley. I don't know if that's something to do with being younger, maybe in an A&E. I'm 28. At the time, I was 26. And I was on a chair for the whole night, so I didn't actually even get a trolley. I had a blanket, and I remember at one point asking for a pillow and being told that there was none left. I got one a few hours later, but I was on a drip, and I was sharing the room with, you know, the bathroom in A&E with everybody else, so visitors and other patients, and a lot of them quite elderly. So that was I was really worried that I was going to pass what I had, because I hadn't been diagnosed at this stage. This was the second day I was diagnosed, and that's when I was worried because I was still in A&E. I was moved into an isolation room, but it was literally just kind of a small room, like a utility room size, down the back of the A&E department, but I was still using the same bathroom and the same facilities as everybody else.
And but are people warned, or is there any indication when you're in a hospital that there is a problem with some people with C. diff?
No, I had no idea. I'd never even heard of it before. And I know it's dangerous for older people, but it's also dangerous, I think, for people with any illnesses like my own that are, you know, sort of chronic lifelong illnesses, especially, you know, bowel illness and things like that, Crohn's and that. I think it's really dangerous. But no, I was tested for it the first day I was in, but I wasn't diagnosed with it until the second day. That's when I was moved to isolation. But even in isolation, was still using the same room as everyone else. But no, I was given a leaflet once I was diagnosed with it. I was given a leaflet to read, just explaining what C. diff was. And I was actually very frightened after I read the leaflet to see what it entailed.
Okay, well, Fergal Hickey, you've heard him on. He's consultant in emergency medicine in Sligo and communication officer with the Irish Association for Emergency Medicine. Fergal, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
How common is C. diff, do we know?
Unfortunately, it's increasingly common, partly as a result of antibiotic use and arguably overuse of antibiotics. I mean, the story that you've just heard and
yesterday's
story are, you know, both distressing for the patients themselves, but also depressing from an emergency medicine perspective, because we know what should happen in these circumstances, and it's clearly not what did happen in the two cases. And the reason for that is a combination of two things. One is that we simply do not have the space to accommodate the patients that are on trolleys plus the normal emergency department workload. So at the moment, as we speak, there are over 300 people on trolleys around the country in the 29 emergency departments. That's completely unacceptable. The second issue is that with one or two exceptions, most emergency departments in the country have a limited capacity to isolate patients. So whether it be a gastrointestinal potentially infective condition or a respiratory infective condition, we do not have the isolation facilities, nor did we ever have the isolation facilities. And even in those places that do have it, they're taken up with other patients who have infection risks.
And that's what worried me as well, because what happened when I moved from A&E and I did get up into a ward, I was put into a room on my own, and anyone that came into the room had to wear, one, a mask, two, gloves, and three, an apron, a disposable apron, every time they came in and left the room. So those precautions weren't taken in A&E, and that's what concerned me, because it was higher density. There was so many people than when I was simply up on my own and I had visitors and things like that. And I remember there were student doctors came in because it was infectious diseases that I was treated by. And when they came in, they had mentioned to me that there's no point in using the alcohol wipes or the gel, hand gel. You have to wash your hands with the bacteria that's in C. diff. It has to be hot water and soap. And I found that very interesting that I didn't actually know that.
But Fergal, surely it's in the hospital's interest, given their workload and the stresses and strains on it. Surely it's in their interest not to generate, so to speak, more patients by allowing C. diff to...
Absolutely. And I mean, I can't agree with you more. This is not acceptable. The irony, of course, is that my association and myself personally and other of my colleagues have been making this point for the last 10 years, that we know that certain conditions are more likely to spread in an overcrowded emergency department, be it influenza, be it winter vomiting bug, be it tuberculosis, be it C. diff. We know this happens. It has happened elsewhere in the world. And yet this is a problem, Joe, to be frank, which isn't taken seriously enough. There is, whether we like it or not, as a society and certainly as a healthcare system, there's an acceptance of the unacceptable. So there's an acceptance that it's okay for people to be on trolleys. Now, the people that are on trolleys because they're sick, and therefore they're vulnerable patients and are vulnerable to the kind of cross-infection that we're talking about and Nicola describes. I mean, this is not acceptable, and nobody who works in an emergency department would ever claim this is acceptable, but we do not have the beds, nor do we have the isolation facilities for things to change, and that is going to require changes made elsewhere in the system.
In what way? Like,
first of all, we need enough beds to be able to admit those patients who need to be admitted, and the second is we need enough isolation facilities. So, and that means having isolation facilities both in the wards and your more recent contributor had the experience of going to a proper isolation facility, but in many circumstances, patients remain in the emergency department because there is no isolation facility for them to go to on a ward, and that just increases the risk. As you say, they're packed into emergency departments, and increasingly, we're seeing emergency departments being used as patient warehouses. Now, that's not a term I use inadvisedly, that's simply what's happening.
It's a pretty good description, I think, though.
Yeah, that people are being packed into increasingly small spaces, often packed in like sardines, either nose to tail or nose to nose in terms of the position of the trolleys. This is not acceptable, and it's about time that we as a society said no more. And that has not happened. There's a grudging acceptance, oh, it's okay to be on a trolley in emergency department. No, it isn't. Once a decision is made that somebody needs to be admitted, they need to be admitted to hospital, and that means to a hospital bed, not to spend their entire hospital admission on a trolley or 3 days in the case of Nicola. I mean, that's not acceptable. It wouldn't be accepted in the third world. Why is it accepted here?
What did you think, Fergal, of what happened, Mr. Jim Gray, up in Tala?
Well, Jim Gray has done what many of us have done, which is point out the unacceptability of much of what goes on at the moment. So you can imagine, I don't know the circumstances of the 91-year-old man, apart from what was reported in the media. However, by definition...
Well, the Minister for Health basically said he rang the 91-year-old man and his family, and they seem generally happy with the standard of care they got.
They may be very happy with the standard of care because people go out of their way to try and provide the best possible care, but in increasingly impossible circumstances.
Will you give me a call? That'd be great.
Yeah, I think there's a certain irony in the fact that this discussion was about confidentiality, and yet the minister rings up the patient. I mean, there's something kind of strange about that. But in
what way? Where did the minister get the patient's number?
Yeah, the data.
It is very much the same issue. I would be very surprised if in the letter that Dr. Jim Gray wrote to the CEO that the patient was specifically identified, and therefore how does the minister find the identity of the patient? I mean, I think it's important that the minister takes personal interest in what's going on because that hasn't necessarily happened in the past. But I think it's ironic to be discussing confidentiality issues at the hospital, investigating confidentiality issues when this happens. But I think the more important issue is rather than saying that the care that that individual got was good and therefore the patient was happy, we need to accept the fact that once you are kept in an emergency department, beyond the time that a decision is made that you require hospital admission, that that is a clinical risk issue. And the older you are, or the sicker you are, then the greater is that risk. So no patient should be waiting 3 days on a trolley, irrespective of how young they are, because that imposes risks. We know this. We know there are delays to people receiving antibiotics. We know there are delays to people receiving pain medication. We know there are delays to receiving cardiac care. All of this has been shown to be the case, and yet we continue to allow it to happen.
Yeah, it's not even just an issue of the matter of the infectious. That's probably pushing it, you know, on a health and safety level maximum. That's kind of saying maximum impact. This is something you need to know now about being infectious, because that's something that will frighten people.
So,
but it's the whole issue of how it's organised completely, who runs the emergency department. I know there's a doctor on call and he's kind of the chief, but how it's actually run, you know, do
well,
they have
I can answer that. But the simple reality is that when you come to an emergency department, you have an assessment carried out by a nurse. What the process is described as
triage.
Yeah. Now, he or she should ascertain in that situation that, you know, you have a condition which is potentially infectious. Now, in your case, clearly because of your pre-existing inflammatory bowel disease, because of your Crohn's disease, there may have been a situation where that was felt to be more, you know, a recurrence or an exacerbation of the condition.
Yes.
But in general terms, if somebody comes with a condition which sounds like it's infectious and therefore is potentially contagious, that patient should be isolated from the moment that information is established. And that has not happened in your case or in the case that was discussed yesterday. And the reason it hasn't happened is there is nowhere to isolate the patient to in the emergency department. So you have the craziest of crazy situations where you have large numbers of vulnerable patients close together, and in the midst of those are any number of patients with contagious conditions. And that's just simply is medical madness. And that's been pointed out for the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something that's just been pointed out in the last week or two. This has been pointed out for the last decade. And as ever, nothing has been done about it. People pay lip service to it. They talk about privacy. They talk about dignity.
And they're all important issues.
Yeah,
but Fergal, the whole argument by the government is that funding has now returned to 2007. The funding is back up. There's supplementary budget. They won't call it supplementary budget, but their funding is...
Well, they can do something if it's
but
all
Joe, the first recorded case of a patient waiting on a trolley overnight was in the Meath Hospital on the 8th of October, 1997. And the situation has just got from bad to worse.
That's a problem
that's been going on for almost as long as I've been a consultant in this country, and it is getting worse.
I would go to A&E maybe once, twice a year, dependent if I get a flare-up of my Crohn's and I have to go in and be put on intravenous antibiotics and steroids and drips and things. And that's my experience. Every time I go, I pack a bag because I know I'm going to be waiting probably about 3 hours to see the triage nurse and then another probably 16 hours in the waiting room until I'm seen. So I know I'm going to be there overnight, but there's never been one time I've gone to A&E and I haven't been admitted as a patient and stayed for a couple of weeks after that with my illness.
And I mean, and that's a very sad and bad reflection on just how dysfunctional the system is. I mean, you should be seen and triaged within 10 minutes of arrival. that's what the system aspires to. That's certainly what everybody in emergency medicine would aspire to. And you should, as soon as you're triaged and identified as being at medical high risk, you should be moved to an appropriate area where you can be managed properly. The reason that doesn't happen is that our emergency departments are increasingly used as warehouses for admitted inpatients.
And that's a concern as well. If they do make this space that you were saying to isolate patients, are they going to take up half the emergency department with these new rooms that they'll, you know, get contracted
to build it in? Well, I think what's important is that it's not just isolation facilities in emergency departments.
Yes.
You need isolation facilities in emergency departments. And as soon as a decision is made that somebody needs to be admitted, then they need to go to a similar type isolation facility associated with the hospital ward.
Yeah.
And that needs to happen. And to be fair, as new developments come in stream, as new wards and new parts of hospitals come in stream, they're increasingly single rooms with the appropriate isolation facilities. But that is not the situation in the current stock of hospital beds, and it's certainly not the case in the overwhelming majority of emergency departments around this country.
Let me bring Margaret Dawson in as contact. Margaret, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
The organisation you founded is?
MRSA and Families Network.
And why did you found that?
Because back in 2002, my husband had a serious operation on his spine, and he spent 7 months in a hospital in Dublin. And at that time, Joe, there was no information about infection. In fact, it was so bad that they would walk away from you and not engage with you, with me or my family. And Joe had spent 7 months of time in the hospital and had to learn to walk again, Joe. And we were very concerned. I was very concerned at that particular time. I knew little or nothing about the infection. But at one point in his stay in hospital, there was 3 deaths in the ward. And the alarm bell started to ring. And there was a feature in, I think, was Even Harold at the time. And a sort of my younger son, Pat, said to me, "Mom," he said, "I wonder," he said, "is that what Dad has?" And I mean, Joe, if you were to come down here to our house and see the wound that that man has in his neck and the upper part of his spine, Joe, you could hide your socks in the wound. And what he suffered was... And that was the beginning. That's, I could get no response from the medical profession at that time. So I decided to go public with our story. And, Joe, that wasn't an easy task.
Yeah.
It really wasn't. But, look, it led to MRSA and Families Network being set up. And at that time, there was 5 or 6 of us in the group. There is now only 2 of us in the group. And we've made great progress, Joe, but there is a lot more progress to be made where infection is concerned in our hospitals. And I suppose over the years, there is a lot more infection out there, you know, that we the public are not really aware
of. What do you think of Mr. Hickey's, Fergal Hickey's point that it's down to resources in the hospital?
Well, you see, Joe, it is down to resources too, but it's doing the very best with the resources you have. And I'm sorry to say this, but infection in our hospitals, you know, there's a little being done, but there's not enough being done. We don't have the isolation wards. And, you know, infection control nurses and their teams are very, very sort of scarce on the ground. You know, I can move forward, Joe, to 2011 when Joe lost a leg over infection.
Oh, my God.
And, I mean, that was horrendous. And, you know, at that stage, I had a lot of information and we educated ourselves. We went to Holland and we went over there in the very early stages. And we, you know, we wanted to learn a lot more about the infection. And C. diff was another one that we were very concerned about. But at that particular time, I spoke out about MRSA and I had no insight into, you know, the suffering and what a patient will go through with C. diff. But it was made a notifiable disease, I think, in 2007. Now, I could be corrected on that. But look, Joe, it's the fact that our hospitals, you know, there isn't enough of isolation wards. Our older hospitals, I suppose, weren't, built to deal with infection.
No.
But it's something we all should be aware of very much. And when Mary Harney was Minister for Health, we met with her. And fair dues to her, you know, she was up against a lot of opposition. And she got the hand gel and all that into the hospital. And there is a team of people working on the hand hygiene committee.
You said the minister was met with a lot of opposition putting hand gel. From who?
From the medical profession. You know, at that stage, they just like, you know, just don't talk about it. And if we don't talk
is
about
that
it...
Is that true, Fergal, insofar as you...
I'd be surprised if the medical profession as a profession, I would have been a consultant then, would have opposed... infection control.
Well, can
process.
I tell you
can I just finish what I was going to say?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is investment required. I mean, Margaret speaks about going to Holland, and Holland, all the hospitals in Holland have single rooms. That's the norm, and has been a norm for a generation. Our difficulty here is that we still have what are often referred to as Nightingale wards, where you have 20 and 30 patients in the one ward, and you've got all kinds of variations, 6-bed awards, 4-bed awards, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The normal should be, and all future developments should be,
single
occupancy rooms.
Okay.
And that requires considerable investment.
But
that's not going to be solved overnight.
Okay, Margaret, you make your point, please.
I'm aware of that it's not going to be solved overnight. And, I mean, you know, I do admit that we have made some progress. But can we not have an area in our hospitals, and I mean, this is going back to the Department of Health and the HSE, where people with infection would be sort of isolated from other patients. Would that not be an option, or is that, would that be possible to have that done?
Well, I think certainly if anybody is identified as having an infection which has the potential to be contagious, then they should be isolated. That should be the standard, and there should be no argument about that, Margaret.
Yes.
And to be fair, I don't think there is any argument about
well,
that.
Well, there's not an argument about it now. But
no, no,
I mean,
no, I'm not sure who would have argued at the time.
Well,
I certainly wouldn't have been able to argue from the point of view if that had been reasonable. I think the difficulty is that we are reluctant to invest. We see health as almost a waste of money. We talk about overruns in health. We talk about expenditure
and
health. This is an investment that is required.
Yeah, but I know you. But like, is it not every single cent from the PAYE tax take, which is a significant tax take, goes into the health service? The income tax take, like it's a major, major.
It is, but Joe, at the moment we're getting the worst of all worlds. So, for example, we have gross overcrowding in our emergency departments, which is the subject that we've begun this conversation by talking about. That's actually costing the health service money, because if you're over 75 and you wait in a trolley for more than 12 hours, your length of stay goes up significantly, your complication rate goes up significantly, and your chances. And I'm not saying it's not important to younger people, but your chances of being able to return to an independent existence decrease significantly. That costs the health service money. So we are currently wasting money.
But what about the point that Margaret made? And Margaret, I'm so sorry to hear about your husband having such a difficult time, and you've been very strong for him to set that up.
And I want to go back to something there again now.
But it's what it does to a person that...
Absolutely.
Of course.
What it does to the person. When I had it, it was mortifying. I couldn't control using the bathroom.
Yes.
And there was people everywhere. And it was
exactly
the pain I was in. I got given morphine, and the morphine didn't actually work. Like, that's, you know, on the pain.
All of this is unacceptable. And I'm not, for 1 minute, trying to defend this.
Yeah.
I have been making the same point for the last decade, which is that this is not acceptable.
And you're right.
It needs to be fixed.
Okay, Margaret,
but
quickly.
But unfortunately, people are not listening to the need to do this.
Margaret.
How are we going to fix it, Joe? We have hand hygiene audits, and we have a
Does
very
it work
high...
for CDIF, though?
We have a very high percentage of doctors and consultants who will not wash their hands. And, I mean, that's, you know, critical to a patient's care on a day-to-day basis.
And to be a patient and ask them to do that is very difficult, because you're in so much pain, and all you want to do is say, did you wash your hands?
But
all you can do is...
They have a little sign now, and I don't know if they wear it on their uniforms or on their clothing when they're visiting the ward. And they said, you know, we're very busy, it's okay to ask. And this, our deal about infection in our hospitals, we need to be doing more. It's fine. We all know hospitals are overcrowded, and we all know that, you know, there's a lack of money. But, Joe, at the end of the day, will money put it right? I mean, the guidelines are there. And I'm going to quote somebody in the medical profession. I'm going to quote two people. I remember when my husband was in hospital, and I spoke about the guidelines on hand hygiene, and I was told, Margaret, would you ever just go away? That's more paperwork. I also had a very bad experience. Now, I have many good experiences.
Okay.
I'm not going to say
it's all bad, and
it's not. But I had an experience in the hospital where Joe lost his leg. And I will never forget it, Joe. I had 4 meetings with the consultant and his team, and not once did he mention, nor wanted to mention, about infection. And it got to a stage where I was going to report that hospital. And before I did that, I wrote to the hospital and I sent him an email. And I said, look, it's only fair that we sit down around the table and we speak about what happened to my husband. And eventually I got the meeting with the consultant and the management team. And I will never forget the gentleman, because, I mean, I don't know, are there some kind of a barrier on consultants, the doctors, the nurses, not to speak about infection? And I didn't get the answers I was looking for. But when I leaving that meeting, I shook hands with that gentleman. And I said to him, straight out, I would be very upfront, Joe, and I have a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge now. And I said to him, look, I said, I know. I said, to the day I die, I said, I know Joe lost his leg from an infection. And he squeezed my hand and he walked away from it, the gentleman.
And is it an infection you believe he picked up in the hospital?
Oh, yes, Joe.
And Fergal, is MRSA still prevalent in many hospitals?
Is probably more prevalent in the community now, particularly in long-term community facilities.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I mean, there has been some significant progress with MRSA. I'm not saying it's gone away. It hasn't. I think it's crucially important that the infection control precautions that Margaret has referred to are applied and applied daily. However, what I would make the point is that, and this happens in the Drogheda's and the Bowman's of this world, where you have 30 and 40 people on trolleys right beside one another, it isn't possible to apply that the necessary infection control SARS in that environment. I'm not saying they shouldn't be applied, but I'm saying in practical terms, it's impossible.
Joe, priority should be given to certain patients, patients that have heart surgery, patients that, you know, have cancer.
But Fergal, Margaret, I sound awful cutting across on a word like cancer, but I just want to take up a point you made about, Fergal, patients can and visitors can, but do patients and do visitors say to someone like yourself, have you washed your hands?
In fact, we have a sign in our hospital all around the place asking that patients ask that question. Okay. In fact, one of my colleagues is the picture, is the individual pictured on it.
When were you last asked?
Well, I haven't been asked because I tend to do it. Because in fairness, We do recognise the importance of it, and perhaps my generation are better at it.
But there was a point that Margaret made there, and Fergal, you might be able to answer it. She said she wanted to report the hospital. She wanted to make a complaint. I have never done that because I've never seen, where is it going to get me? Where is it going to go? Well, who do I complain to? Do you know who I complain to?
You do.
Well, each hospital has a complaints, a patient services officer, a complaints officer that coordinates complaints, and if you don't get a satisfactory response from that, it is possible to go up the line, up as far as the ombudsman, if necessary.
Right.
So there is a complaints process. I think,
but not on clinical matters. The ombudsman won't deal with
No,
matters.
Not on clinical matters. But within the individual hospital, they will deal with clinical complaints. But not that they can't take the clinical complaint to the ombudsman.
Well,
but there are other avenues.
The minister has announced a new initiative.
But what if you receive an apology from a hospital? You know, is that good enough?
Well, I think what's important is that the apology is meaningful and that something happens on the back of it. I have had to apologise to individual patients for lapses in their care, but we certainly try in that situation to fix the problem. But this is a problem outside the emergency department that other people need to fix, and unfortunately affects Nicola's experience and your caller's experience yesterday.
What did you get an apology for, Nicola?
When I went out, I was when I was discharged from hospital after a couple of weeks, I was too sick to go, I was too sick to walk to the car, so I asked for a wheelchair, but there was no porters available. I didn't feel well enough to be discharged, but I was. And my mum helped me back to the car, and then within about 2 weeks, I think I was back in hospital again, back in A&E, waiting 16 hours again.
And why, you got an apology for an early discharge, is that it?
I don't know if it was. I think it was just the way everything was handled that I had to come back. That I wasn't well enough to leave in the first place, and that things had escalated again because the second time I came back, it was actually my illness had been triggered now by the C. diff, and I was now very, very sick with my Crohn's.
Okay, and finally, Fergal, we are hearing more from yourself. I know you're communications officer with the Irish Association for Emergency Medicine. But we are hearing more now from consultants than we did before, didn't we, in terms of emergency departments?
Well, I think, as an association, we've been speaking out for many years. I think the difficulty for individual consultants in a hospital is if they speak out about the care received in their hospital, they're often regarded as the problem rather than the issue that they're raising. So, we've seen this happen in the case of Tala, where the response of the hospital has been to investigate the circumstances that Dr. Jim Gray's letter got into the public domain. What Tala Hospital needs to do is ensure that there aren't patients on trolleys, something they were able to do in the immediate aftermath of the HICRA report in May 2012. So it is possible to fix these problems if the political will and the management focuses there. And I think the difficulty we've had is that there hasn't been.
Okay, I presume the association stands four square behind Jim Gray if he's
absolutely
facing
any
disciplinary.
You'll probably be aware that a number of consultants have spoken to the media, which wouldn't be their normal practice in the last couple of weeks, pointing out that the situation of having patients in excess of 90 years old on trolleys for more than 24 hours was not just an issue in Tala, it's all over the country, and it is getting worse as the patient population ages.
Okay. Fergal Hickey, Mr. Fergal Hickey, consultant in emergency medicine, Sligo. Nicola, best wishes to you and Margaret. I hope Joe I know he's in your care, but I hope things improve continuously. Thanks, Niamh, Margaret Dawson, Nicola and Fergal Hickey.